Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today we are joined by economist and author Dr. Lawrence White, who has recently published a book called Better Money, Gold, Fiat, or Bitcoin. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. White.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, if you'd like to briefly lay out what you hope a reader will take away from your book, we'd be certainly interested in that. It's one of those many times where I invited somebody onto the show about a specific topic only to find out immediately thereafter they just wrote a book on it. So excellent timing for sure.
Well, I've been interested for several years in cryptocurrency, and before that in the gold standard. But I discovered a few years ago that very few people were interested in hearing about the gold standard anymore. So I had to retool and learn about cryptocurrency. And of course, it's a fascinating topic. But this book kind of brings together and compares and contrasts what I know about the gold standard with what I've learned about cryptocurrency, Bitcoin in particular. So the idea is that we have three candidates to be our money. The gold standard served as our money for a long time. We currently in the United States and just about everywhere else in the world have a fiat currency, meaning a currency unbacked by gold or silver or any real commodity, but just issued at the decree or by the power of the government. Fiat is a Latin term meaning let it be. So it's in English, it's a decree, is a fiat. And then the third, which has just come along recently, is Bitcoin. There are, of course, other cryptocurrencies, but Bitcoin is by far the leader. So I focus on that one. And the question is, how do they compare as potential monetary standards? Which one would provide the kind of money people want? Which I take to be a money of relatively stable purchasing power and a money with a very wide network of transactors. And I take that to be the preferences of the public because that's what we see demonstrated in markets. We see countries with high inflation, people opt to put themselves on a better money. And so you get spontaneous dollarization, it's called in Latin America, or Euroization on the fringes of the Eurozone. You don't see people putting themselves on the Swiss franc, even though the Swiss franc has a better inflation record than the dollar, because it doesn't have as big a transaction network. So in the book, I first talk about the history of monetary institutions and how there's a lot more of it in the private sector than in the public sector, so that talking about private monetary standards like the gold standard or a Bitcoin standard, where the money is not, the basic money is not issued by governments, is in fact the normal state of affairs, or historically has been a common state of affairs. Then I've got a chapter on how the gold standard works, a chapter on how fiat standards work, and a chapter on how a Bitcoin standard works. And by work, I mean how the quantity of money is determined and how the purchasing power of money is determined. And therefore, what can we expect about the stability of the purchasing power of the money? And in the last chapter, I compare and contrast gold standards and Bitcoin standards. And my conclusion is that a gold standard better guarantees or better assures, maybe guarantees the wrong word, better assures us of a stable purchasing power of money due to the different supply mechanisms. The gold standard, you have a decentralized supply of gold from the gold mining industry, and it provides more money when people want more money, so that the quantity of money responds to an increase in demand and not so much the purchasing power. In fact, in the long run, if the cost of extracting gold doesn't change, then the purchasing power of gold doesn't change in the long run. There may be short run fluctuations as it tries to catch up with changes in demand, but you get long run purchasing power stability, and that's clear in the historical record of the gold standard. Whereas a Bitcoin standard has a completely inflexible supply, the quantity of Bitcoin is predetermined by the program that issues Bitcoin, which there's a fixed release schedule. So we know at every date what the quantity of Bitcoin is going to be, regardless of its purchasing power. So there's no response to an increase in demand except a rise in price. So we've seen this in Bitcoin, that the purchasing power is very volatile. And for that reason, it's a very dangerous way to hold your rent money or your grocery money in a world where your groceries and your rent are priced in dollars or some other currency. So it's hard for Bitcoin to achieve a critical mass of users as a commonly accepted medium of exchange because it's so volatile. So my conclusion is that if fiat standards fall apart, then it's more likely that people will migrate toward a gold standard than toward a Bitcoin standard.
Excellent. Now, many people seem to think that a gold standard is synonymous with full reserve banking. That's often the same people who like and are championing a gold standard. I guess Rothbard was one of these.
Yeah.
Also seem to think it should be a full reserve, but that's not necessarily true. And you explain some of that in the book, that each one of these possible monies can serve as a base money, but that doesn't mean that we can't have banks extend credit off of that base money.
That's right. So Rothbard and Milton Friedman and some other people have referred to a 100% reserve gold standard as the true gold standard or the genuine gold dollar. But they're confusing the standard with the banking media that are available. So historically, in most places, because it has very strong economic advantages, people used bank-issued money rather than lugging around sacks of coins or warehouse receipts to coins. People used money issued by banks, which was backed less than 100% by coins in the vault and was mostly backed by interest-earning assets held by the bank. And the advantage of that to the banker is obvious. If the banker can take some of the coins deposited and lend them out and earn some interest, that's to the banker's advantage. And you might ask, what's the advantage to the depositor? And the answer is, in a competitive system, bankers are going to pay interest on deposits, and they're not going to charge storage fees the way they have to if they're just acting as warehouses. So my view of the historical record is that people saw those two alternatives and opted for fractional reserve banking because it gave them a better deal. So it doesn't have to be a fraud. It doesn't have to trick people to get them to use it. It just offers them a better deal.
So here's an analogy I'd like to put out. I find that this is helpful to a lot of people. It's helpful to me anyway. I like to envision banking, not always just in money, because that can actually get pretty tricky talking about money. But instead, imagine you have 100 lawnmowers and you want to store these lawnmowers somewhere. So you store them at a warehouse. And then full reserve banking would be like the warehouse charging you a small fee to have all of this space for your mowers. Then you can come and use your mowers whenever you please. Fractional reserve lending would say the warehouse person could rent those out for you. That would cover the storage fees. You would get some of the rent for the mowers. And what I find interesting here is, although there's a confusion when we just talk about money between a narrow and a broad money, it gets pretty simple when we talk about a real asset like mowers. And I want to run this by you and see if you think that this is correct. So in that scenario, I could use 5 of my mowers, and then the other 95 are rented out, and they may arrive at another storehouse, another warehouse somewhere, where somebody else seeks to hold these mowers because they may use them very quickly. However, here's the point that I think is important. Many people seem to think that this type of fractional reserve lending of lawnmowers is creating new mowers, but it's not. There's something different happening. The base amount of lawnmowers is the same. However, there are claims to the holding of these such that we could access it. So I have a claim on 100. Somebody now has a claim on 95. But that shows the difference between the base money in this scenario and the broad and the narrow money, if you will. If at some point I wanted to get all of my 100 mowers back, one option could be the warehouse would simply go on the rental market and seek to rent me back the amount of mowers that I demand, which would be similar to the interbank trading rate. And if interest rates or rental rates in this scenario can provide an arbitrage opportunity, then that will be taken. But how do you envision how do you describe to somebody the difference between the broad and narrow money in a fractional reserve lending system?
I like your analogy. It's important to specify that I know that this is the arrangement that's happening, and that I understand that if I want all 100 mowers back, it may take some time to get them assembled. So the question that often puzzles people is, how is it feasible for a bank to issue more claims than it has claims to gold coins, let's say, than it has immediately available gold coins in the vault? And I say immediately available because the bank has other assets. It has typically loans, and banks that issued these claims that were immediately redeemable on demand understood that they can't hold assets that are completely illiquid. They have to hold assets that are easy to sell when they need to get more reserve money. So anyway, people have been puzzled by the question of, how is it feasible? How can they get away with it? How can they not constantly be disappointing their customers who come to get coins and can't get them? And the answer is, people don't only use gold coins to make payments once banking emerges. They use banknotes and they use checks to make the payments that the coins would have made. So they don't have to go back to the bank and demand the gold coins back every time they want to spend. They transfer a claim on the bank, and that's in the 19th century what people commonly did. They paid each other in banknotes, and the banknotes were claims on the bank. They said right on the face of them, we, the so-and-so bank, will pay the bearer on demand $10 in coin or in legal money. And so anybody could, who held the note, that's the bearer, could go in and claim them. But they normally didn't, because the banknote does everything for them that the coin does. The economist Ludwig von Mises had an analogy or a contrast. He said, suppose you issue 100 loaves, suppose you issue tokens. Each token says, good for one loaf of bread. Well, you can't eat the tokens. So when people want bread, they're going to redeem the tokens. And the person who issues the tokens had better have 100 loaves of bread, setting aside people losing the tokens. But the remarkable thing about banknotes and checkable deposits is that they are like tokens that you can eat. They do the job of the thing that they are a claim for. So you don't need to come back and claim the coins when you can pay with banknotes or when you can pay by writing a check.
And then, right, that makes...
Yeah.
Yeah, so it sounds like the coin is like owning the mower. And of course, that allows you to mow your lawn, but having the credit that's extended to somebody is like renting or using the mower, which also allows you to mow your lawn. And the question of, well, how on earth could the bank have multiple claims on the same thing? Well, that's no different than saying, how could five different people mow their lawn with the same lawnmower? That's actually a bit of a non sequitur. Of course they could. They would just all be using that mower at different times. And then they all have a right and a claim to the use of it, even though it could be a different person who actually has a claim to the ownership of that base money or that base mower. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So historically, in the Middle Ages, we can see both warehouse banking, if you want to call it banking. Warehouses don't make loans, so it's a little odd to call them a bank, but you can have warehouse banking side by side with ordinary banking, fractional reserve banking, where the banks do make loans out of their deposits, and it's sometimes in the same institution. So it was understood that if you just wanted the bank to store your money, you would bring it, your coins, in a sealed bag. And it was understood that the bank wasn't supposed to go into the bag. And you could get this very same bag back. But for that service, you had to pay a storage fee. So if you just wanted storage, then 100% reserves makes sense. It's like renting a safety deposit box. But if you want to access the payment system made available by banks, which is much more convenient for many purposes than lugging coins around, then you brought your coins in loosely, and the bank would mix them with other coins. And when you wanted coins back, you didn't insist on getting the very same coins back, right? All the coins are interchangeable. So you get as other coins worth the same amount that you deposited when you want to withdraw your deposit. And so the fungibility, to use a technical term, of the coins makes it possible for people to be able to redeem whenever they want, provided they don't want every moment to withdraw.
Mm-hmm. And you made a good point earlier that banks do have something which they're, when they create that money, that checkable deposit, they do have something on the other side. And that would be some type of asset. It would be a debt claim on something. And so it could be that there's $100 in circulation, and 10 of those are backed, if you will, by gold, or in our case, a Federal Reserve, you know, deposit somewhere. But then the other 90 could be based on what's on the bank's balance sheet. So it's not that there's nothing on the other side. There is something, but the bank has to then ensure that what it's issuing as far as deposits are redeemable and have the value to be redeemable with, in one case, gold, or in the fiat currency that we have now, a Federal Reserve dollar, right?
Yeah, so banks historically were very careful to send the money out in ways that they could be assured of recovering it. So they didn't make very speculative loans, and they didn't make 30-year fixed-rate mortgages when they had immediately redeemable deposits. They made very short-term loans, often by buying the equivalent of commercial paper, that is, instruments that only had 90 days to run, and for which there was a very thick secondary market, so they could be sold very easily without a loss. And in that way, banks paid, when they banks did pay attention to the status of their reserves. If it started to go below what's normally safe, then they would replenish the reserves by letting loans be repaid and not just rolling them over, or by selling the assets, as many as needed, to replenish their reserves.
Right. So they have some type of cushion. They have some type of capital that they can buffer these things against.
And well, then it's not their capital. It's their cash reserves, their what you might call secondary reserves, which are the easily liquidated assets.
Right. Right. Okay. All right, so that's fractional reserve lending. So let's get into a comparison of, I guess it sounds like fiat and gold were probably the the two we can focus in on most, because I don't know too many people who are advocating for a Bitcoin standard, though I'm sure they're out there.
They're on Twitter.
They're on Twitter. Okay, great. So it sounds like there could be some good reason to have a fractional reserve lending system. You mentioned that it did historically outcompete full reserve, which shows that the users of money, the users of banks, seem to prefer being able to get that rent on the use of their money when they deposit it. So it seems to be preferred. It ended up predominating. It has a way of self-regulating in some cases. I'll let you pick. Would you like to talk a little bit about free banking versus having a strong Fed? Or do you want to get right into the question of which type of base money we should use?
Well, they're related. It is important in a gold standard system that the issue of gold redeemable banknotes and deposits not be monopolized. So free banking refers to a system where there's competition, where there are multiple banks of issue. And competition is important because the banks of issue then discipline one another. So suppose you have 20 banks, each one issuing its own brand of banknotes, but they're all on the same standard, and it's in the interest of a bank to make sure that its banknotes are accepted at face value. So if they're all denominated in dollars, where the dollar is the name of a silver coin, as was the case historically, then the bank wants its banknotes to be accepted at 100 cents on the dollar, not at 95 cents on the dollar, because that would be a hassle for its customers. It won't be able to attract customers. So banks made a great effort to cooperate with other banks. Our bank will accept your notes at face value if you accept our notes at face value, and then we'll get together and swap the claims on each other that we've collected every day if there's enough business to justify it. And then only the difference between the two do we have to settle up in gold. So clearing systems acted as the most immediate restraint on the overissue of notes. Any bank that issued more notes than people wanted to hold would find people depositing those notes in other banks and the other banks coming to demand redemption of them. So the signal to the bank that overissued is we're losing reserves to the other banks. That means we can't just keep reissuing these notes without draining ourselves of reserves. So there's this decentralized feedback mechanism through the clearing system that keeps each bank in line. Whereas if you monopolize the issue of notes, and this was the case historically with the Bank of England, when they overissued notes, the notes would diffuse through the country. Other banks would hold them because they were, rather than send them back for redemption, because to the other banks, they were a form of reserve money. And so it wouldn't be until this extra money in the system had driven up prices throughout England and led to people buying more imports, because imports were now cheaper, local prices have gone up relative to world prices, that gold would start to drain out from the entire country, and the Bank of England would then start losing its reserves. So it was a much slower process, and so the overissue could get much bigger before it was corrected. And then you get the overissue being so large that it causes a artificial business boom that then collapses when the reserves flow out and the Bank of England has to contract credit. So,
gotcha.
Okay.
Okay.
So with a free banking system, a gold standard is self-regulating. Individual banks are disciplined by their neighbors, and the system as a whole is disciplined ultimately by the loss or gain of gold from the rest of the world. And for the world as a whole, there's a scarce amount of bank reserves of gold coins, and banks have a desire to have adequate reserves against the risk of reserve outflows. And so there's a determined amount of money in the world. And it's governed over years, over decades, by the output of the gold mining industry, but the output of the gold mining industry is such as to stabilize the purchasing power of gold for the following reason. If there's an increased demand for gold so that its purchasing power begins to go up, that makes it more profitable to mine more gold. It pays now at a higher purchasing power of gold to dig a little deeper or to send out prospectors. And so over the years, the output of the mines will increase, and that additional output will accumulate until it meets the additional demand for gold. And so the purchasing power of gold will come back down to the level governed by the marginal cost of extracting gold. In a fiat money system, there's no such self-correcting force. Central bank can issue all the fiat money it wants. The Fed can issue all the dollars it wants, thereby eroding the purchasing power of the dollar, or diluting it, if you like. It's like adding water to a bucket that's half full of milk. You get more liquid, but you don't have any more purchasing power. You don't have any more nutrition in the bucket of diluted milk. And there's nothing that compels the Fed to withdraw the excess money. What equilibrates the system is that the price level rises. And the faster the Fed expands the money supply, the higher the inflation rate in the price level. So without some constraint on the issue of fiat money, we get higher and more variable price levels. And that's what the historical record shows. Inflation rates under the classical gold standard were pretty close to zero. And under fiat money, it's, 4% and above. There are very few countries that have kept inflation below 4%, and many that have kept had inflation in double digits, and a few even triple digits. But there's no tangible constraint. So if the central bank is subject to political pressure to print money, it prints money, and we're off to the races as far as inflation goes.
So what would it look like to have a free banking system with fiat currencies? So basically, we have the same story about banks can issue currency, mm-hmm. but we still have a clearinghouse. So if they start going bananas and they don't have anything, I mean, in that case, I guess the reserves would be other types of assets, and assets would flow in the form of different things on their balance sheets to other banks. Couldn't that be a self-regulating system as well? Or do you think that gold is necessary in order to have a well-run free banking system?
A free banking system on a fiat standard would give you a well-regulated quantity of bank-issued money conditional on the amount of reserves the banks have. But if the central bank creates too many reserves,
what if the banking system
will reverse that.
So what if there's no central bank in that situation? It's just independent banks, each issuing credit, which has to be at parity with all the other banks for the reasons you said earlier, that nobody would want to be spending Wells Fargo dollars if they're a different amount than every other dollar out there. So what about just that environment?
Well, it's an interesting question. There are at least two scenarios. One scenario, which Friedrich Hayek talked about in his book, The Denationalization of Money, imagines that there'll be Wells Fargo dollars, and there'll be Bank of America dollars, and there'll be Chase Manhattan dollars, J.P. Chase Morgan. mm-hmm. And they don't necessarily trade at par, that there can be fluctuating exchange rates between them. And Hayek optimistically forecasts that each bank will be concerned to keep inflation low or zero in its own currency. But because they're independent units, there's no redeemability, there's no interchangeability. All that keeps the system, all that keeps the exchange between Wells Fargo and Citibank what determines the exchange rate between those two is the foreign exchange market or the interbank exchange market. So there wouldn't really be a single par to which they all adhered. Because there isn't any one thing to which into which they're all redeemable, right. Unlike okay. a gold standard. What was my second scenario going to be? So if there's some common medium of redemption, then everybody can be at par in terms of that medium of redemption. So without a central bank issuing a fiat medium of redemption, not clear who it's going to be. I guess what I had in mind was George Selgin imagined a world in which we use Federal Reserve notes as the medium of redemption, as the thing that banks hold in their reserves and offer to exchange their own banknotes and deposits for. But we've shut down the Fed, and we just have a given stock of Federal Reserve notes. And then that can be held by banks as reserves. And so it would be like kind of like a gold standard, except that we don't have to worry about the gold mining industry. It would mean that the quantity of money is of base money is fixed rather than varying in a way that stabilizes its purchasing power. But it would clearly be less inflationary than a system like we have today, where the quantity of base money can grow a little bit or a lot in a given year.
So you mentioned earlier that the under the gold standard, we had very low inflation, especially over the long term. I did see, I found a graph a while back from, it was produced by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And it shows that 1882 to 1932, inflation under the gold standard was 0.87%, which is pretty fantastic. Whereas
that's 0.87, less than 1%.
Right. Yeah. So then we have 1973 to 2016. We have that period. We're not under the gold standard. That's 4.06. But the interesting thing that I saw was not that we have lower inflation under the gold standard. I think that makes sense, but that the standard deviation was actually larger under the gold standard, which to me seems like a downside of having the gold standard. If we can have price fluctuation, which is larger, That is an issue, even if over the long term we get inflation, which is more stable. So is that a trade-off? What exactly is going on there? Is it that the fixing the gold price causes that volatility to be pushed into other goods and service prices? Is the gold standard just slower to respond? Therefore, we get a larger standard deviation in the price of goods and services. I'm really interested in your comments on that.
Okay, well, this is getting a little deep into the weeds. There are different ways to measure volatility of purchasing power. And if you look at the standard deviation of the year-over-year inflation rate, then you do see more variation under a gold standard. That's what I think you were reporting. But under a gold standard, it tends to be negatively correlated, meaning years of inflation are followed by years of deflation to get back to the long run trend. So the price level under a gold standard is mean reverting. Whereas under fiat standard, it's like a random walk. So in a paper I did with George Selgin and Bill Estraps, we try to measure the forecast error that people would have had trying to predict the price level 5, 10, 20, 30 years out under a gold under the classical gold standard compared to under the fiat standard we've had with the Fed. And the forecast errors are lower under the gold standard because for that, it doesn't matter just what any one year does relative to the previous year, but what happens over the entire 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 years. And there, under a gold standard, if the price went up for a couple of years, there's a larger chance of it coming back down than of it continuing up. And as I said, it's mean reverting. It comes back to the trend. A lot of the volatility in the inflation rate year to year in the U.S. was due to a very weak banking system. So the financial panics of the late 19th century are associated with shrinkage in the amount of bank-issued money as banks are contracting credit and trying to save themselves. If you look at Canada, where the banking system was much stronger because they didn't have legal restrictions that weakened the banks the way we did in the United States, you don't see as much variation. And in interest rates, there was more volatility in the U.S. as people scrambled for liquidity than in Canada, where the banks expanded and contracted to satisfy changing demands for currency relative to deposits.
So speaking of scrambling scenarios, some people have said that gold standards are susceptible to speculative attacks. People start redeeming a whole bunch, and now the quantity of gold is less than it was, and it's backing less. There's less backing each dollar. Now people are worried that they can't exchange it. And then the whole thing can collapse. I guess there's a Bank of England, what is 1932 style. Do you think that's a fair critique, or do you think that there's ways that the natural balances in terms of the gold standard system can defend against that?
I think it's an exaggerated critique. The Bank of England in the 30s was trying to go back to the pre-World War I parity between the paper pounds and gold pounds. But during the war, they had vastly inflated the price level. And there had been a little bit of return to the old price level, but only very partial, so that when they tried to resume in 1931, the gold pound had a much higher purchasing power than the paper pound. Or to put it another way, the price level was about twice as high as it needed to be to reestablish convertibility on a sound footing. So naturally, when they said, okay, you can redeem your paper pounds for gold, and people saw that the gold bought a lot more than the paper pounds because of the inflated price level in paper pounds, naturally they rushed to redeem, and the Bank of England didn't have enough gold to satisfy them, so it had to quit. It had to suspend again. But that wasn't a problem every year under the classical gold standard, where the price level was in line with the purchasing power of gold, because there hadn't been a big inflation in the meantime. So I blame the fragility of the pound during the interwar period and of other currencies during the interwar period on the inflation that they created during the First World War. Once you create an inflation like that, and if you want to go back to gold, you either have to devalue so that you can make the paper currency equal in value to the gold currency by marking down the value of the paper currency, recognizing that the inflation has taken place. Don't pretend that it's still equivalent to the same amount of gold. Or you need to wait until the price level comes back down to make it feasible. So the U.S. during the Civil War, the federal government suspended the gold standard, issued paper greenbacks, drove up prices denominated in greenbacks relative to prices in gold dollars, and then waited after the war, stopped issuing money, let the economy grow to the point where prices in greenbacks came back down. And in 1879, so 14 years after the war ended, they finally resumed. And that was completely a non-event, because there wasn't any arbitrage reason to rush to redeem. The gold didn't buy any more than the paper dollar now bought.
Okay. So you mentioned earlier how gold has an ability to, over the long term, regulate inflation. And it sounds like there are periods where governments can change the relative value between, say, greenbacks
when
and
gold. When they go off the gold standard, yeah, gold is no longer restraining the overissue of money. And so they can drive the price level up in terms of paper dollars or greenbacks.
And then afterwards, it would have to come back. So we'd have to have deflation. If we're sticking with the gold standard, it would regulate that run up by having a period of deflation thereafter.
If you want to go back to the old gold content of the paper money, so if you don't want to devalue, so in the U.S. it was $20.67 per ounce of gold. If you wanted to go back to that relationship, yes, you need to deflate. But an alternative is to devalue. And of course, the U.S. did devalue when Roosevelt changed it to $35 an ounce. So that's your choice, deflate or devalue. And we got some mix of the two in the United States.
Of course, it's more politically expedient to devalue a lot of that time. But it sounds like oftentimes the critiques that the gold standard is deflationary, it sounds like a lot of that could be that it's regulating the long-term inflation rate, and it's actually undoing the effects of over-expansionary policy when the government chooses not to change the value of the relation to gold money.
Yeah, people overstate the extent to which a gold standard is deflationary. And they overstate the damage it does in periods where there is deflation. So ordinarily, if you haven't had an intermediate period of inflation on a paper money standard and are trying to get back to it, you only get deflation that is a falling price level in response to previously rising price level. And it corrects the change, and the magnitudes are very small. So if you look at year-to-year inflation when the U.S. was on the gold standard before the First World War, you might have a year of 1% or 2% rising prices, followed by a year or two of 1% or 2% falling prices. It wasn't, apart from financial panics, there weren't catastrophic deflations. Over the entire period, there were stretches where prices were falling, but falling because the output of goods was growing rapidly, faster than the output of gold in the world. So if that's what's causing falling prices, the fact that you have more goods chasing each unit of gold, that's entirely benign. That's a deflation associated with rapidly growing output, not with a recession. And there was a paper done by two economists at the Minneapolis Fed who found that if you average over five-year periods, periods of falling prices under the classical gold standard were not associated with recessions. And periods of recessions were not associated with falling prices. Right? Because much of the time when you had falling prices, it was because output was growing rapidly relative to the supply of gold. So the supply of gold wasn't keeping up right away. So there's such a thing as very benign deflation. Deflation is, you have to distinguish between a deflation driven by rising output, which is benign, and the bad kind of deflation, which is driven by a collapse in the money supply. That you do want to avoid, but a gold standard with free banking avoids that.
Right. Okay. So the gold miners are going to say, hey, with this deflation, if I was able to find an additional ounce of gold, that would relate to, say, well, back in the day, what, $35 a long time ago? And $35 buys me a ton of stuff, maybe even a ton of mining equipment. So it's a really good deal. Whereas if it's a period of inflation where prices have been driven up, then in that case, you're going to say, well, my ounce of gold, i.e. my $35, isn't going to get quite as much because things have the price have gone up. So is that the regulation mechanism that's going on?
Yeah, exactly. So the gold miners are going to say, I don't get to buy as much with the last ounce of gold I extract. And the wages of gold miners have gone up with prices, so it's not profitable to dig quite as deep as I was digging. I'm going to scale back a bit until the price of gold comes back up. Why mine it now when the price is low, when I can mine it later when the purchasing power is low? Why, and when I can mine it later when the purchasing power is back to normal?
Now, there is a critique I always had against the gold standard, but it really only applies to the full reserve versions. I was always troubled by the fact that given the size of our economy, to get that regulation would involve an absolutely vast amount of gold if we were on a 100% full reserve system.
Yes.
And to back money in general would be a nearly impossible task to do. But you pointed out in your book something I thought was really cool, was that if we had a fractional reserve system with gold as the base money, then the amount of gold that we would need per year would be the cost of less than the budget of the Federal Reserve. I thought that was a fantastic point.
Yeah, so a 100% reserve system is very expensive. It takes a lot of gold mining. It will induce a lot of gold mining because it will drive up the purchasing power of gold compared to a system where we economize on gold by mostly using bank-issued money. So Milton Friedman had a famous estimate of the resource cost of a gold standard, but he assumed 100% gold, and not only against checking deposits, but also against savings deposits, which doesn't really make any sense. But yes, then you would need, his estimate was 2.5% of national output to be devoted to gold mining,
right?
In order to keep up. And that would be very expensive. Whereas if banks, instead of having 100% reserves against M2, which is the measure of bank deposits that includes all bank deposits, including savings accounts, if instead of 100% reserves, banks had what was historically reasonable, 2% reserves, then the cost is cut by a factor of 50. And so it's much less expensive. There is still a resource cost, but, you know, locking your bike with a metal lock is more costly than locking it with a paper lock.
Yeah, it also answers the critique that if we had to go on a full reserve gold standard, then wherever we're buying gold from, that's certainly going to benefit a bunch of malevolent nations like China, Russia. These are huge gold producing nations. So if we're all of a sudden creating an incredible demand in order to use it as currency under a full reserve system, then I'm not really comfortable transferring that much wealth to countries I'm not thrilled about.
Yeah, it used to be the case that the gold mining around the world was dominated by Russia and South Africa. Both, and those were the days of apartheid, so they were both unsavory regimes. That's actually not true anymore. Russia's not even in the top 10 gold producers anymore.
Oh, wow.
It's become much more decentralized around the world with new technology. But China, as you said, is a major gold producer. I forget what their percentage is. It's less than 10%. So that's not as much of a problem. And if you went to a gold standard with fractional reserves, something that is worth taking account of is that the public would stop speculating in gold against the devalue or loss of purchasing power of the dollar, against inflation and against financial crises. So since we went off the gold standard, the private sector has accumulated so much gold as hedges, they now own more gold than central banks do. And that has contributed to driving up the relative price of gold. And so we haven't saved any resource costs of mining by going off the gold standard. It's a great irony, because we haven't convinced people that there won't be inflation, and therefore they buy gold to hedge against inflation.
Right. So that was an awesome point.
So with the real price of gold higher, we actually have more gold mining today, more resources expended on gold mining.
That's incredible. Yeah. No, you really have changed my view on a lot of this. I'm still thinking through some of the issues. I just kind of pigeonholed the gold standard as just a full reserve system. And under that, guys, I don't really like it. But a free banking gold standard, I think that's pretty slick. So I'd be interested to hear how you would rank. If you could put these four systems in order, I'd love to hear, and you could design each one. So a full reserve fiat, a fractional reserve fiat, a full reserve gold, and a fractional reserve gold. If you were to put those four in order of what you would like to see in our nation, where would you rank them?
Well, that's a tricky question for the reason that my real most important normative commitment is to free choice in currency, so that it should be up to each money user what kind of money they want to use. And here you're offering to make me a dictator, which I would absolutely not want to be. But, you know, based on historical evidence of what kind of money people want, I would say that a fractional reserve gold standard would best satisfy people's preferences for a stable valued money and a money that you can spend all around the world. And then after that, I don't know, as between a 100% gold standard, that is an international standard, but it would be very expensive. And to keep it from becoming cheaper, to keep people from using fractional reserve methods to make themselves better off, to make payment system cheaper, would take a fair amount of coercion, because there are all kinds of financial contracts you have to outlaw if that's what you want to do. When it comes to a fiat money system, you're not economizing on anything by having fractional reserves, because fiat money, it doesn't cost anything to produce, unlike gold. So it's not clear that you should prefer fractional reserves under a fiat standard. But it all depends, how desirable a fiat standard is relative to 100% gold standard. Entirely depends on how responsible the issuers of fiat money are. So if I were living in Switzerland, I would rather have a fiat standard than 100% reserve gold standard. But if I were living in Zimbabwe, I would think that the security of a gold standard would be worth it. And this is a practical choice that people face in many nations. So in Argentina, right now, they're having a presidential election, and they have 140% inflation. And so one of the leading candidates, whose name is Javier Milei, is proposing that they officially dollarize Argentina. And officially dollarizing means adopting the dollar as their reserve money, which is very much like going on a gold standard. And they're going to have to, bear the expense of holding dollar assets. Although does have the difference that they can hold interest-earning dollar assets. The banks can hold interest-earning dollar assets to back their dollar liabilities. So it wouldn't be as expensive. But they would give up the ability to pay the government's bills by printing money. So there is some fiscal cost to it. The public in Argentina has already pretty much dollarized themselves. I mean, most people hold their savings in dollars. A lot of transactions are in dollars, especially for big ticket items. And the amount of pesos people hold in purchasing power terms is very low.
So it sounds like fractional gold is your number one.
Yeah.
Then number two would depend on
how bad the fiat money is.
Okay. And then did I understand you correct? You were saying that your number two would be either full gold or full reserve fiat?
I think I would favor fractional reserve fiat over full reserve fiat. Because it takes, as I was saying, a lot of resources devoted to coercing people not to engage in fractional reserve contracts when it's interest to do so.
Right. Yeah, I think that one's often, this is only just on the blackboard when we're comparing full and fractional fiat. But, shadow banking, regulatory arbitrage,
right.
And then there's all the issues of just the fiscal and monetary entanglement you get with full reserve. You're putting a lot of additional, I mean, weirdly, it's a lot of people who are more libertarian leaning. I find many of them push full reserve, but that pushes a lot of power directly into the hands of the government to change the money supply and takes it out of the hand of private bank actors.
Right. You mentioned shadow banks. One kind of shadow bank is a money market mutual fund. And one of the economists who favors 100% reserves, Joe Salerno, has recognized that people would want a cheaper payment medium that didn't have a problem of runs, and a money market mutual fund fits that description. And he would allow people to use checkable money market mutual funds because technically they aren't banks. They aren't issuing debt claims. They aren't promising to pay you back a certain number of reserve dollars. So that's okay with him. And because mutual funds are not run prone, it's another way to have a payment system that's not run prone besides forcing banks to hold 100% reserves.
So that's that would be an equity claim instead of a debt claim?
Exactly, right. So
Then you're just pushing the I've kind of thought about this briefly.
It does,
because there are people who kind of push this kind of idea. To me, it just is displacing where you want your volatility. Like, do you want it in the person who's holding that currency? At which point, all right, yeah, you hold that money market mutual fund, your money could be more volatile because it's an equity claim. But if you make it a debt claim, like we would have in other systems, am I right in assuming yes. that's pushing the volatility to the macroeconomic
environment? Yeah, and so banks insulate you from changes in the value of bank assets, right? The value of your checking account doesn't change if the bank has a good quarter or a bad quarter on its asset side. But in a mutual fund, the value of your claim does change with the performance of the portfolio. How much risk that is depends on how risky the portfolio is. So money market mutual funds hold very low risk assets. And so there isn't much movement in the value of the portfolio if they're well managed, and it should only be upward.
Hopefully. Yeah.
But in a world of zero interest rates, it's a problem. Money market mutual funds have had the problem that sometimes, their assets aren't earning much, so there isn't always enough income to offset declines in the value of some assets. And so sometimes they have negative yields. And then what do? They have to reduce the number of shares in somebody's account, or they have to mark the price of the shares down.
Sure. Yeah.
So,
No. Keep going if you had more to say on that.
So money market funds have traditionally, instead of changing the price of the shares so that they add up to 100% of the portfolio, they've issued shares worth $1 each, just added shares as the value of the portfolio grows. Mm-hmm. But then what do you do if the value of the portfolio drops? You either have to have the backing, the corporation that owns the money market fund, inject capital,
right?
Or they have to break the buck, or which sort of makes it less similar to a checking account, or they have to withdraw shares. But as you said, that's just a different way of putting the risk on the shareholders. But they have to do one of those things.
I mean, as a user of money, I'd certainly rather have, that debt-based claim where I just know my dollar's my dollar's my dollar.
Right. As long as the bank has adequate capital to cushion you against changes in the value of its assets, which is what banks traditionally did.
Right.
I say traditionally because under deposit insurance, they don't need to have adequate capital to assure you that you won't get all your money back. They just put that sticker in the window.
Right. Well, I do wonder if we're creating a bit of a tragedy of the commons problem. Everybody, of course, would like to have stability in their money, but is it reasonable to have that at the expense of pushing that risk into the macroeconomic, environment or into the banks? I think yes. But that would be maybe another episode. And as would getting into the FDIC insurance stuff, I will have one last question on that. Is it true that banks have to pay a premium for the like insurance premiums on that? And is that actually adjusted based off the risk of the particular bank?
Yes, banks pay something called a premium because it's supposed to be insurance, remember?
Mm-hmm.
But oddly, they also pay insurance premiums, so-called FDIC premiums, on deposits that are legally uninsured. That is, deposits that are over the $250,000 limit. So it's really more like a tax than an insurance premium. And as to risk adjustment, which is something an insurance company does, of course, you pay higher premiums if you present a bigger risk.
Sure.
The FDIC used to do that not at all, but then there was a law passed in 1991 called the FDIC Improvement Act, which mandated that the FDIC risk adjust the premiums they charge banks based on what the auditor's report said about how risky the bank is. And it's in the interest of the FDIC to do this because it gives banks an incentive to be safer. And that means less likely to draw down the funds of the FDIC. But people who've studied it, economists and finance people who've studied it, say the risk adjustments they've actually made are much too small. That is, very risky banks pay almost the same premiums as the safest banks.
Yeah, it's not a market-based price discovery.
That's right. So because there's no competition in this market, there is some, actually. There are private sources of insurance for deposits that are over the insured limit. But in a normal insurance, there isn't, competition for the basic deposit insurance. We don't get the price discovery that we get in normal insurance markets, which is basically if the insurance company is charging too much to be actuarially fair, some other company will underprice them. And if they charge too little, they go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
The FDIC ran out of money in 1991 when so many banks were failing that it wiped out their fund, but they didn't go out of business. Instead, they got a big loan from the Treasury. Remarkably, the FSLIC, the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, did go out of business. Congress actually shut it down.
Wow.
After 2/3 of the savings and loans failed, and the FSLIC couldn't pay off all the depositors without getting a big transfer from the Treasury.
Well, I promise this is the last question. Would you support a private version of FDIC insurance? Or do you think that we should not require any insurance, any risk insurance on banks to make sure that people's deposits are safe? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I would support that kind of reform. It has to be phased in because banks aren't holding enough capital right now to reassure their customers that they're not going to fail should a fair number of deposits be withdrawn. So they have to assure their customers they have adequate capital to survive asset losses. You may remember Silicon Valley Bank, which had most of its depositors over the insured limit. So effectively, most of the deposits were uninsured. And they became insolvent. They became insolvent because their bond portfolio was 20 and 30 year bonds, which they had bought when yields were 2%. The Fed, as part of monetary policy, raised interest rates from near zero to 5%. Raising interest rates makes the value of assets fall, especially long-term assets, because there's a lot of discounting in the present value. And so their bond portfolio crashed in value. And now their assets were less than the liabilities, so they couldn't pay everybody back. When word of that got out, there was a run on the bank, and that's what closed Silicon Valley Bank. So they didn't have enough capital to absorb those losses. And part of the reason they didn't was regulators weren't requiring them to hold capital against interest rate risk. sovereign debt, which is what they held, is given a risk weight of zero by the by the regulators. And its default risk is probably zero for U.S. Treasuries, but not the interest rate risk. And the interest rate risk matters when you can't hold the assets to maturity because your customers want to withdraw.
Right. And because, you know, a lot of people think, well, they were totally underwater. But I think you just pointed out key facts there. If they hold it to maturity, things would have been okay, right? Like a lot of that story's true, that they did have enough to cover everything. But yeah, when you get a huge amount of depositors fleeing, well, then you're forced to realize the prevailing rate for those bonds, which is marked down because new bonds are much more valuable given their higher rates.
Yeah, once you sell a bond at a discounted price, we can't pretend that the bonds are still at par.
Right. And then the whole thing comes crashing down.
And that's why traditionally banks without deposit insurance didn't invest in 20 and 30 year bonds. They held short-term assets.
I like that they would get a choice between they would get to choose at that point how to spread out their risk. Do they want to spend a little bit more for a premium and hold riskier assets? Do they want to hold really safe assets and then pay less of an insurance premium? I think it'd be pretty cool if banks were given that choice and it wasn't just a one size fits all FDIC insurance or the other tax, which I'm going to just call the too big to fail tax.
Yeah. So we haven't even mentioned the fact that in practice, everybody is insured. Well, there's some uncertainty about whether the bank is considered too important to allow the uninsured depositors to take losses, or AKA too big to fail. But for a bank that's too big to fail, everybody has insurance.
Right. Well, let's wrap it up there. I could talk to you about these things all day, but I'm sure you have lots of professoring to do today.
Yeah.
But definitely appreciate it. I'll remind the listeners that you have a book out. It is called Better Money, Gold, Fiat, and Bitcoin. I'm almost done reading it. I've been jumping through different sections. So mostly finished. And I found it legitimately very, very good. What I really look for in books on difficult to think about topics is clear thinking, just readily understandable, thoughts. And that's exactly what I found from start to finish. So I really appreciated the clarity that you put in that book. And I did legitimately change my mind on a few things. So I appreciate you helping me
evolve
my thinking on this. The fractional reserve gold standard, I think, is seriously got to be considered. I think making that pairing of the fractional with the gold really is quite the neat type of synergy. So I would encourage anybody to go out and buy that. The link is in the show notes. And I make an offer to my listeners that if they are a student, a grad student or something, and they're generally broke, but they really want the book, they can always write to me at thegordianknot101@gmail.com. And I will send them a book if money is a problem. If there's a guest on the show who has a book, I always make that offer. All right. Well, Dr. White, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.